and welcome to the BRC's new Trade Policy Podcast. My name is William Madison, and each edition of these podcasts will be reviewing the latest developments in global trade affecting the high seas to the high street. I'll be joined by the BRC's other William, our trade policy expert, Mr. Bain, to explore what's new in global trade and what it means for you. So, as I said, William Bain is here with me now. William, it's been a very busy time for trade and supply chains, given all the events unfolding around COVID-19. What are your major concerns about how this is impacting global trade routes for retail and also the rules-based global trade order more generally?
Well, it's been quite a dramatic series of events for trade, because if you look at the World Trade Organization's forecast for global trade output this year, it's set to fall from between 13% on the low part of the band right the way up to 32%. So that would be an astonishing restriction on the amount of trade that we're doing across the globe. And I think the real concern is that some states, perhaps motivated by responses domestically on COVID-19, are introducing things like export bans, export restrictions, quotas. It's making it very difficult to get goods in and out of countries and into importing markets. And the fear is that under the cover of COVID-19, we see a lot of measures which are protectionist. And as we've seen from previous economic and public health crises across the world, protectionism does not work. And protectionism is a bad answer to the problems that people are facing. So I think it's been really interesting to see a lot of countries coming together in recent weeks. We've seen the EU, the US, the UK sign new commitments lodged at the World Trade Organization, which will, I think, ease some of the problems that we're having with the hoarding of goods. It would be a particular concern if we had hoarding of food or grain or crops. And so those measures adopted in Geneva should at least provide some support and bolstering for global supply chains. We have members who've had it more difficult to try and get clothing and textiles out of some countries. Obviously, there's a global issue with the supply of personal protective equipment and medical supplies. So anything at this stage which diminishes the barriers to trade is a good thing. That's why the UK and the EU, for example, have scrapped VAT on imports of masks and other vital medical equipment. But we have this bigger problem now with trying to sustain our supply chains. And for retailers, the principal problem is getting imports into the United Kingdom.
So specifically on that question of imports, I wanted to ask about any recent successes that the BRC has had, specifically relating to import duties and taxes in what is obviously quite an uncertain trading environment for most retailers.
Well, indeed. One of the problems that some of our members said to us was that stock was at sea coming to the UK. They'd managed to get it out of their exporting market. But obviously, they wouldn't be allowed to sell the products when they came to the UK. And that could cause some issues in terms of cash flow. So we put this to Treasury, and we were successful in getting a deferral mechanism. And that means that companies which would face severe financial hardship, paying a big duty bill or big import VAT bill up front, can have a deferral decision made by Treasury in order to offset what would otherwise be a real cash flow problem for that company. So that's something which was an industry-crafted solution. The Treasury adopted it, and I think it's an example of good practice, quick policymaking in response to a real difficulty that's emerging with supply chains.
Yeah, that sounds like a really good result. I just wanted to turn to a slightly different topic. Obviously, bolstering global trade requires strong decision-making bodies to enforce the rules fairly. I understand there have been some recent developments in Geneva at the World Trade Organization, both on agri-food supply chains and also dispute resolution among some of the key members. In practical terms, what do these steps mean for UK retailers?
Well, firstly, on the measures which have been taken in terms of agri-foods, the key, I think, theme behind them is to avoid hoarding of foods and crops, to make sure that these can be lawfully and fairly traded and fairly supplied across the world. And so we don't have blockages in the supply chain, which ultimately would affect the consumer in the UK. So those are good measures that around 50 states have taken. And I think we can be hopeful that they may broaden out into other supply chains as well and into other product sectors. In terms of dispute resolution, there's a really interesting point because, businesses want certainty, countries doing trade want certainty. And one of the sort of key characteristics about the WTO is that when there is a dispute on trade, there has been an appellate body which was formed, which is capable of laying down binding arbitration rulings and providing predictability about what the rules on trade actually mean and how they should operate. Now, the US decided at the end of last year it was not going to nominate a new arbiter to the appellate body, and this meant that it fell into disuse, so it was no longer functioning. So there was nothing providing a sort of binding ruling between countries in terms of dealing with the consequences of trade disputes. So the EU and China and around 16 other countries have negotiated between them something called the MPIA, which is an interim dispute resolution arbitral body, which means that if there are any disputes that come up between those countries, they can be resolved in Geneva through this interim mechanism. And so that does provide some certainty that rules will be applied in a consistent and binding way. Now, the US obviously has not joined that. The UK does not seem to be joining for now. It seems to be adopting a wait-and-see approach. But I think this issue is really important in terms of the rules-based order. If you don't have a sort of functioning, binding appellate authority in Geneva, then it gets very difficult to properly enforce the rules of the game on trade. So this is important for business in the UK, and it's something we'll be very much keeping our eyes on over the next year. And of course, it'll be influenced by what happens in the US election in November as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So moving on now to another major topic of conversation, obviously the UK-EU negotiations. In a month's time, the last round of talks will have been concluded ahead of the high-level review of progress made. What's really happening in negotiations? Do you think, in your opinion, we're likely to see an extension to the transition period agreed by the end of June?
Well, we seem to be having a sort of very prolonged rehearsal of positions which were already clear and known. It was very clear from January, really, when the EU was publishing a whole list of papers and slide decks about the principles that would underpin its position, and the UK's document in early February, in a sense, setting out its position, what the problems would be. Which are that the EU believes that in order to do a zero tariff, zero quota deal between the two parties, something it hasn't done with any other third country, that as a result, there has to be some binding commitments in terms of production and subsidies of goods, which again, do not see any parallel with any previous country. And this is known as the level playing field. So, the EU believes that the UK should sign up to, in the trade agreement, a whole list of binding regulatory commitments in terms of environmental policy, competition policy. State aid in particular would be very strongly enforced. And the UK disagrees and says this is an infringement of its newfound sovereignty, and it does not have a parallel in any of the EU's previous trade agreements like those with Canada or Japan. The other problems are about the governance of the agreement. So the UK would probably prefer a whole range of different approaches to deal with any disputes that arise from the agreement. The EU would prefer a sort of overarching governance structure, and that has been a point of major disagreement. Fisheries is a huge point of disagreement. The EU believes, in a sense, there should be something kind of analogous to the arrangements it has with Norway and Iceland. The UK thinks that there should be a much looser arrangement that respects, again, its newfound sovereignty as an independent coastal state. There are also other, perhaps smaller issues which are causing problems. So for example, in relation to the protection of human rights, the EU is saying that the UK should guarantee domestic protection of human rights in the way that it's doing at the moment through the Human Rights Act. The UK is saying, well, again, that's an issue of sovereignty and we can't bind successor governments and shouldn't. And also, I think, where the UK might be seeking selective access to certain databases, for example, Europol in terms of dealing with crime and maybe some others, and the EU is saying, well, you reject any role for the European Court of Justice, so how can you have this selective access that doesn't happen with other third countries? So I think we can see, just in accounting and where things are at the moment, also issues of difference over rules of origin. The UK wants a very expansive set of rules of origin that would allow accumulation with other third country agreements that the EU has made before and the UK is trying to replicate now. Whereas the EU wants a more off-the-shelf approach on rules of origin based on the Pan-European Mediterranean Convention. And so these problems, I think, do demonstrate that this is why trade agreements take time. You know, the average length for the EU to do a trade agreement before was around 4 years. And again, we can see why. So, as you say, we do have just two rounds left. It looks very hard to see how there's going to be any change in position, any sort of come and go between the two parties on those key issues of difference in the time that we've left. And remember that the disruption caused by COVID-19 has robbed the process of around half of the negotiating time that there should have been already. So it does appear really difficult to see how, by that high-level summit in June, it can be demonstrated that there has been enough progress to satisfy both parties.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, there's a lot of uncertainty still out there. Do you have any guidance for UK retailers about how to prepare in the face of all of this uncertainty?
Yeah. So obviously the two forks in the road that await us at the end of June are either the talks collapsing completely and then the, you know, UK and EU will be trading with each other on the basis of WTO agreements and things like customs and intellectual property and those sorts of things, or that there is an extension mutually agreed by both sides that could last for up to 1 or 2 years. And I would still say that looks the most likely outcome. There'll be a lot of twists and turns in the road before then, but that looks the most likely outcome by the end of June. But as we know with this whole saga, nothing is guaranteed, that's for certain. And so that takes us to the point that, you know, there are some preparedness notices which the EU issued last week, which are for EU companies or companies that might have some cross-border transactions involved. So there's something of interest in those for members on everything from customs to chemicals. But what we are waiting for are some equivalent UK documents, which would set out the arrangements for UK companies. Now, we have contacted the UK government asking for such documents in those areas where we know that there are going to be changes no matter what is negotiated. So on issues like customs and VAT and excise in particular, you know, we know the parameters of where both sides will get to if there is any agreement. But even if there isn't an agreement, we broadly know what the arrangements would be. So the question is, how can the government help companies start to prepare on those issues where there is a bit less doubt, for example, than on what rules on checks on products of animal origin or rules of origin or tariffs might be. Those issues are perhaps much more in the to be decided area.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of news still to come, shall we say, in that area. So a second set of trade talks commenced this week between the United Kingdom and the United States. What are the prospects of these being concluded by the end of the year?
Well, as we're speaking, these discussions are getting underway. It all happened very quickly at the end of last week. We understand that Trade Secretary Liz Truss had a call with USTR Robert Lighthizer, and there will be a sort of round lasting 2 weeks that will get underway today. There are clearly offensive and defensive interests that both sides have. Clearly for the US, they want to find new markets for agri-food products. They want to see tariffs on those products lowered as far as the UK is concerned. The UK would like to sell more in the way of services, but also some other sort of products, more niche agri-food products to the US as well. Maybe a bigger market for things like pork in the US. Pork pies, I think the Prime Minister once said, was a key issue for him to promote in these talks. But the real difficulty that I would see is really this, that I mean the US will want this deal to allow fairly unrestricted access to its agri-food produce in the UK, and the sort of the way that, you know, standards are monitored is different between the UK and the US. The UK has the precautionary principle at the moment, which flows from being part of the EU for 46 years. The US has a different approach. You know, a lot of issues in terms of food standards are dealt with at the end of the supply chain rather than throughout. And I think that regulatory difference gives rise to a big political issue. You know, we've all seen the sayings about various chicken products and beef products, hormone treated beef. So there are quite a lot of issues there to be overcome. The UK is saying it's not going to change its regulatory approach in relation to agri-food. The US is saying, well, really, you have to in order to provide the kind of access that they want for their agri-food produce, like beef and pork and chicken. So that, I think, is going to be one of the big issues. And also services, you know, what can the UK get in the other direction? The biggest problem is time is very limited for this to be enforced by January. It would have to be negotiated by early autumn, get through Congress, get through whatever steps are required at Westminster. It doesn't seem likely at this point that a full agreement, a full free trade agreement, could be reached in that limited window available. But it is possible that there could be more limited phase one mini agreements made, perhaps on assessment of different standards, perhaps lowering certain tariffs when the UK leaves the transition period. Those are the kind of things which could be done in time for the election in November, but very unlikely that there'd be a full FTA.
So we also know that negotiations have concluded now between the EU and Mexico on a refitted trade agreement. What are the key elements of this, and is there anything that we should be looking out for that might affect the UK at all?
Yes, well, negotiations here finished last week. There is now a process of legal scrubbing. So the agreement has to be reduced to legal text and one that will stand up one that lawyers are going to be happy with. You also have ratification, not just in Mexico, but in the European Union. And of course, France and the Netherlands this week have said that they're going to introduce some new tests for new EU trade agreements before that they would consider ratifying them. So that could be quite a tricky process. It could take at least 2 years from where we are now. And the key thing about the agreement is that it basically goes to tariff-free on just about all product lines for goods. So it's a substantial improvement in access to each other's market. Now, from the UK's perspective, it's true this agreement has been concluded during the transition period, but because of what we said about ratification, even if there were an extension of 2 years, it would be very unlikely that the UK would be deriving benefits from this agreement as things stand. It would be out with even the maximum possible length of the transition period. But what I think it does mean for the UK is it may seek similar types of arrangements with Mexico, and we shall see what happens there. The Mexico UK agreement has not been rolled over as yet, and that is perhaps down to the fact that people are waiting and seeing what was done with Brussels first.
Great. Well, that seems like a good place to leave the conversation for today. Thank you for listening to the new BRC Trade Policy Podcast. Thanks again to you also, William Bain, for joining us.
Bye. See you next time.
And we hope that you found this podcast useful. If you're interested in hearing more about the work we do at the BRC, please visit us at brc.org.uk. Bye for now.